From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, in spite of heavy federal restrictions on psychedelic drugs, researchers are investigating them as medicine for mental illness.
Psychedelics are the best thing that has ever happened in the history of psychiatry, the most promising tool.
Author Helen Oyeyemi with a new take on an old fairy tale.
You think it's going to be a quick job, like just dash in, rescue the wicked stepmother, everything will be fine, and things unfold.
And in her latest album, Diane Reeves explores new musical territory.
Well, I think people have come to know that I am not comfortable in a box.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. The United States and other world powers have said that Russia's actions in Ukraine are a clear violation of its international agreements. One of those agreements is known as the Budapest Memorandum, signed in 1994. Stephen Pfeiffer is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and is now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And he was part of the American team that negotiated the terms of the memorandum.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine had on its territory the world's third largest nuclear arsenal. It was bigger than Britain, France, and China combined. And the Ukrainians were prepared to eliminate that arsenal, to transfer the warheads to Russia for their dismantlement. But the Ukrainians asked for certain things. And one was security assurances that the United States and Russia would pay attention and respect Ukraine's independence, sovereignty, territorial integrity, that there would be no use of force or threat of force against Ukraine. And the 1994 Budapest Memorandum of Security Assurances was the document that reflects those commitments by the United States and Russia, also joined by Great Britain, to extend to Ukraine those assurances, including respect for its territorial integrity.
Now, when you look at events over the last couple of weeks and look against especially those first couple of points in the Budapest Memorandum, what do you think?
Well, I think it's very clear that Russia is in violation of its commitments not only under the Budapest Memorandum, but also commitments that it's made as a member of the United Nations and also as a member of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. What you see happening over the last week in Crimea is nothing less than a Russian military occupation of the peninsula.
And the United States, along with Great Britain, is part of this agreement. So what are the U.S. responsibilities?
Well, there's a very important reason why it's the Budapest Memorandum of Assurances and not of Guarantees. And we were very clear, and the Ukrainians understood this back in 1994, that we were not going to use the word guarantee because we were not prepared to extend a military commitment. So I think that given what we see and this threat to Ukraine's territorial integrity, the United States and Britain by that are committed to extend various measures, political, diplomatic, even economic, to support Ukraine and try to push back against this Russian violation of the memorandum.
So required to do something, but it's not entirely clear what that something has to be.
It wasn't exactly specified, but there was certainly at the time a clear understanding in Washington that the United States would react. And because the Ukrainians in 1993, as we were getting ready to bring this to closure, made very clear that a key element for them in their decision finally to get rid of those nuclear weapons was going to be having some kind of a commitment that had the Russians in particular signing on, respecting their independence and their sovereignty and a pledge not to use force.
So looking across the world, Muammar Gaddafi gave up his nuclear program, and then several years later, he ends up getting overthrown and killed. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons for these guarantees, and they end up getting ignored, it seems, over the last couple of weeks. Are you worried about the message this sends to countries with nuclear programs, Iran, Pakistan, North Korea?
Well, it may be slower than some like, but I do think that the United States and the West are now gearing up to do a couple of things. One is to be supportive of Ukraine, including politically and also working with the International Monetary Fund financially. There are also a number of political, diplomatic, economic sanctions that are now being laid out towards Russia. And I think that is important in two cases. It matters for Ukraine and our commitment to Ukraine, but it also is an important signal for security assurances in general. It's not inconceivable, for example, that if we get to a final arrangement with Iran, whereby Iran addresses the world's concerns about its nuclear program, that security assurances could be part of that package. And we don't want to discredit security assurances by how we handle them with Ukraine.
That's Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and is now a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. Ambassador Pfeiffer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
In 1966, psychedelic drug advocate and former Harvard professor Timothy Leary appeared on the Merv Griffin Show.
Dr. Timothy Leary has been described as being either a prophet or a fiend. He is the dominant figure in the current uproar on the use of LSD. In 1963, he was fired from the Harvard faculty for involving undergraduates in his experiments with drugs. A man very much in the news. Here is Dr. Timothy Leary.
I'm in the unfortunate position of being about 20 years ahead of my time. You know, when the airplane came along 20, 30 years ago, the older generation, to a man, said, "They'll never get me up there. I don't want to get high." The next generation, everyone's flying around in airplanes.
How many times have you taken LSD, Doctor?
I've taken LSD 311 times.
We'll be right back.
You can tell that sounded completely insane to the studio audience. It was the late 1960s, the summer of love, the massive anti-war protests, and experimentation with psychedelic drugs. The authorities cracked down on hallucinogens, reclassifying them as Schedule I drugs, meaning they had no known medical use. Research on the medical uses of LSD and other psychedelics was effectively shut down. Today, scientists are picking up where Timothy Leary and others left off. Psychedelic research is back, and that's our cover story today.
Timothy Leary's dead. No, no, he's outside looking here.
Back in the 50s and 60s, Stanislav Grof was one of the leading researchers on the therapeutic applications of LSD and other hallucinogens. He studied their effects on mental disorders, including addiction. Grof says LSD seemed to accelerate treatment of mental illness exponentially. Some alcoholics even appeared to be cured, never touching a drink again after their LSD session.
It was quite extraordinary. This was a tremendous deepening and acceleration of the psychotherapeutic process. And compared with the therapy in general, which mostly focuses on suppression of symptoms, here we had something that could actually get to the core of the problems.
But the pervasive image of LSD was as a recreational drug and not a medicine. By the 1970s, research had been stigmatized. But in the 1990s, attitudes began to change. There was a flurry of studies on psychedelic drugs. By the 2000s, there was a small but growing research community picking up where Grof and others had left off. One area that showed promise was using hallucinogens to ease anxiety and depression in patients with cancer. Patients like Erica Rex.
I was diagnosed with breast cancer stage 2 in 2009, on April Fool's Day. Great day to be diagnosed with breast cancer. Even if people are happy to spout statistics at you about your chances for survival, that's not exactly what happens in emotional or human terms. I went through the treatment, and there's a group of drugs called aromatase inhibitors. They have extreme side effects, and that can also include depression, which for me it did.
Erica told me she became obsessed with the possibility of her death. It was crippling. And then Rex found out she might qualify for a depression study using an experimental drug, psilocybin. It's an active compound in psychedelic mushrooms. Just to get into the study was an ordeal. Tons of lab tests, days at the hospital, and then a very intense psychological workup with some probing questions.
One that stuck out was, do you think that people on the television or the radio are saying things specifically to you, or that there are coded messages in advertising, stuff like that? It's like having 5 years of therapy or psychoanalysis stuffed into 3 days. It was exhausting.
But at the end of it all, she was approved for the study. She would be given 2 doses of the hallucinogen in 2 separate sessions, with trained guides sitting with her as the drugs took effect. Now, what she's about to describe is an intense drug experience, a trip. It's also a science experiment. Her experience began in a windowless room.
The setting is basically a room, an office or a hospital room, and it's been decorated with sort of lots of hangings, and it looks like a sitting room. It's comfortable enough. They have a blood pressure machine because they take your blood pressure every 15 minutes or half an hour during the whole experience.
So then you take the hallucinogen, psilocybin. What does a psilocybin pill look like?
It was a little purple capsule. You take the capsule, you drink a whole cup of water, and you have an eye shade on, and you have earphones on through which there's music. They have a very elaborately thought out music track that they play throughout the day that doesn't repeat. It started out being very ecclesiastical. The music became very absorbing and involved. I mean, it went to symphonic music, which I prefer and which was much better, and then kind of world music, you know, things that were more kind of indigenous type music from foreign countries. It was a journey. There was a progression of things that happened. There was one that was very particular in which I was being confronted by a little boy with a slingshot who had his arm sort of braced in a tree and was ready to shoot a pebble at me. And then that was one image. And then something funny happened and I started laughing. And my laughter was then jewels, like sparkling jewels or starlight pouring out of a sky, an aperture in the sky. I can't verbalize it because people want it to be described as though it were a dream, and it's not. It is actual, so it is as real as my sitting on the bed, clutching this microphone, and it's all entirely real.
But it wasn't all starlight and laughter.
I became nauseated. There were parts of the struggle with nausea that brought back things, issues that were from my family, from my young life that were excruciating and upset me a whole lot. At the very end of the day, as I recall, the last song that is played at the end of whatever it is, 6 hours, is Here Comes the Sun. And then you go spend an evening with a trusted person and write up everything that you can possibly remember.
Coming away from this now, with some distance from it, how has it affected your depression?
I am much better. I am able to plan. I don't sit around obsessing about what the future may hold nearly as much.
Erica Rex tells me her depression lifted and her life is undoubtedly better. But as much as the psychedelic experience helped her, some authorities say there are significant questions about whether they are safe and effective for everyone. Glenn Hansen is a senior advisor for the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
I think there still needs to be an asterisk next to it. I don't think that it looks like a brand new antidepressant. There are enough people who've gotten into trouble with these things, and we know that there's this lack of predictability.
Hansen says the main problem with hallucinogens is that they affect people in wildly different ways.
There are people who get into trouble with these drugs. Usually these are folks who have emotional disturbances already in place, and you superimpose like an LSD on someone that's a schizophrenic, and you don't know what you're going to get, because that's almost the definition of hallucinogens, is you go in and you scramble the chemistry of the brain. And if it's already scrambled, again, I put that in quotation marks, but if it's already abnormal, where are you going to end up with this person?
Remember all those questions Erica Rex had to answer before her session about voices in the TV and coded messages? Those were meant to screen out people who might have trouble, but Hansen says questions like that aren't foolproof. Charles Grobe is at UCLA, and he's one of the few researchers actually studying medical uses of psychedelic drugs. Even he agrees there are reasons to be cautious, but thinks federal regulations are still too strict.
Our work, we feel we've demonstrated very good safety, as have the other researchers in the field. Where the risks come in are in a recreational setting, where naive individuals who really don't know what they're getting into take it under adverse conditions, often mix it with alcohol or other drugs. That's where you have the serious potential for adverse outcome.
Can we talk about the current regulations with research on these drugs? What sort of restrictions are there? What sort of hoops do you have to jump through?
For starters, you have to go through FDA. You then have to go through the DEA. And then in California, we have our own kind of in-state oversight body that looks at all research with Schedule I drugs, and that's the Research Advisory Panel of California. So many hoops to jump through. To work in this area, one has to be very patient.
You talked about how thanks to Timothy Leary and folks like that, there had been kind of a stigma. Does that persist? Is it difficult to get funding?
Well, funding is very challenging. It has not been possible to get funding from the National Institutes of Health, at least up to now, for funding these kinds of projects. Hopefully that will change, and hopefully in the near future there may be some opportunity to see some progress in that arena. But up to now, all of our funding has come from private sources, which is at times, particularly in a difficult economy, a difficult task.
Despite the difficulty finding funding, Charles Grobe and others are pressing on.
I think we need to recognize the 60s are over. They're long gone. Timothy Leary is dead. Moody Blues sang that a long time ago when he wasn't dead, but now he really is dead. He's off the stage, and I believe we're on the threshold of some very exciting discoveries that the health fields can only benefit from.
Grobe has been approved to begin a new study next month using the drug ecstasy to treat social anxiety in adults with autism. Timothy Leary may be dead, but a new debate over the use of psychedelics is just getting started. Up next, meet a brand new fraternity.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
Well, it's not really like that, I'm afraid. There's no drinking, no wild parties or debauchery. I'm talking about Alpha Lambda Mu, the first social Muslim fraternity in the country. If you think that sounds funny, don't feel too bad. Ali Mahmoud, who founded Alpha Lambda Mu, says it started as a joke.
Mango juice keggers, something along those lines. And then I thought about it a lot longer, and I realized that there was this void for Muslims on campus. A lot of us come from immigrant families.
Mm-hmm.
And so growing up in America, a lot of us kind of have to live a double life. We have to live a life where we try to please our family in terms of our Islamic upbringing. And then we go to school, many of us public school, and we're just trying to fit in. We're just trying to be cool.
And I have to imagine that if you are a serious, or not even that serious, a Muslim, but just observant, and you want the brotherhood of being in a fraternity, if you're not drinking alcohol, it's probably not a very welcoming place.
Yeah, and it's not to say that all fraternities are like that.
Sure.
But a lot of them are. And so for the most part, because there is that stereotype, many Muslims who, like you said, observe the religion kind of turn off the fraternity scene. They're not into the drinking. They're not into the hookup culture. And so providing this alternative, it allows us to engage in what we want to and embrace what we want to.
I want to talk about the Kufi Crew videos. Now, did that predate the fraternity? Because you said this started as a joke, and it seems like kind of your sense of humor.
Kufi Crew started with the beginning of the fraternity. And if you watch the video, most of it is us joking around. I believe it starts with one of the members punching another member in the gonads and then running off and praying so that he can't get punched back. So that really captures kind of what our fraternities, what goes on in our fraternity. We're just college kids in America trying to have fun and figure out who we are.
You don't have to be drunk to find shots to the groin amusing.
Right. We're pretty crazy on our own. I'd be afraid if you hung around us if we were intoxicated.
Do you worry about the fact that maybe this is isolating Muslims a little bit? Or on the other side, if somebody's going to be Islamophobic, what's scarier than Muslims in a secret society? You know?
Right. Well, for anybody who is worried about us being a sleeper cell, I'd refer them to the Kufi Crew videos. I can see where that concern is, but in all honesty, I don't really see how this can be fostering us from assimilating into American culture, because we have nothing to assimilate to. We are American. We are American Muslims. Those two don't contradict each other at all. And so we're not hiding away ourselves. We're just living with people who have the same beliefs that we do.
Obviously, there's a wide range of diverse beliefs and views in Islam. Do you try to bridge that gap between conservative and more liberal sides in your own community?
Right. So we have this group of guys who are on both sides of the spectrum and everywhere in between of what it means to be a quote-unquote good Muslim. And it forces the people who are less practicing or less externally practicing of their religion, it kind of puts them in an environment more conducive to reaching the goals that they want to. And then it takes the kids who have been fostered their entire life and been isolated from quote-unquote lesser Muslims and it puts them in a position where they have to tolerate them and they have to understand them. So really, everybody's benefiting, and we meet at this middle ground we call brotherhood.
Ali Mahmood is a junior at the University of Texas, Dallas. He founded the first and only Muslim fraternity in the U.S. Ali, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Boy, Snow, Bird. This is the three-word title of Helen Oyeyemi's new novel. It's a version of the Snow White fairy tale told through the voices of three characters. Boy is the mother of a daughter named Bird, and the wicked stepmother of another named Snow. Snow is white. Bird is black. Like the fairy tale, Helen Oyeyemi's story is about beauty, envy, and identity. And like the fairy tale, mirrors are not to be trusted.
Nobody ever warned me about mirrors. So for many years, I was fond of them and believed them to be trustworthy. I'd hide myself away inside them, setting two mirrors up to face each other so that when I stood between them, I was infinitely reflected in either direction. Many, many me's. When I stood on tiptoe, we all stood on tiptoe, trying to see the first of us and the last. The effect was dizzying, a vast pulse, not quite alive, more like the working of an automaton. I felt the reflection at my shoulder like a touch. I was on the most familiar terms with her, same as any other junior dope too lonely to be selective about the company she keeps.
When I was a kid, I loved doing that infinity thing with the mirrors. I could never get enough of that for some reason.
I didn't discover that for ages.
So this is set in mid-century Massachusetts. I'm sure you've been asked this question. You were British. You were born in Nigeria. What inspired you to set this book about race in 1950s New England?
Reading the fairy tale, the way that it's so explicit that Snow White's beauty is tied into the whiteness of her skin, there seemed a very clear connection to me with the 50s and 60s in America, when there was very much a debate over the rights of a human being based on the color of their skin. And so it was very interesting to me to place this very white-seeming girl in the middle of that historical context.
And there's a way in which this book kind of takes apart the perversity of that obsession over skin tones. I don't want to give too much away, but passing is a major feature of this one family. We should explain this specifically. This means African-Americans who passed as white. Can you talk about that in this family, what it meant for them?
It meant a boost in their social standing. It meant this curious thing where in order to be yourself and to have people leave you alone, you need to pretend to be something else. Like there's a scene in the book where Olivia's talking about her love of opera and just being in the opera house and how she was quite sure that if people knew that she was black, they would look at her differently and wonder what she was doing there and what she was trying to be, when really she just loved opera. And it was a very sad thing that somebody could feel that they would have to go that far just to be able to enjoy the simple things that they like.
You mentioned Snow White, and of course there are a lot of resonances with fairy tales in this book. There's snow, of course, makes you think of Snow White, the fairest of them all. What fascinates you about fairy tales?
I think that the purest form of story that you can get, they sort of strip down human behavior to the absolute basics. So with Snow White, you have this story about envy and what the consequences of those are. And I suppose that when I'm reading a fairy tale, I find it easier to figure out how to rescue the characters than with other stories. And I wanted to rescue the wicked stepmother. I felt that, especially in Snow White, I think that the evil queen finds it a bit of a hassle to be such a villain. It seems a bit much for her, and so I kind of wanted to lift that load a little bit.
It's kind of funny, though, you're doing that in a novel, which is, it's not simple. It's complicated and overdetermined, people are messy.
Exactly. You think it's going to be a quick job, like just dash in, rescue the wicked stepmother, everything will be fine, and things unfold.
The book deals with teenagehood in a really raw and direct way, the way we are inside the head of some of these characters. Is it wrong-headed to assume a sort of kinship? Because I know Bird makes sense of her world through writing. She talks about that. And I know, obviously, you had your first novel, I think, when you were 18. You've clearly been writing since you were young.
Yes. Well, the kinship that I feel with Bird is more to do with her being a mimic, weirdly.
How do you mean?
She throws people's voices, and I think that I throw voices in my writing. I'm basically assembled of all the bits of writing and all the stories that I love, and I try and find ways to pull different things out of the box. And so, yeah, I'm a sort of literary mimic, and Bird is an auditory mimic.
You mentioned that your first novel came out when you were 18, and you've got a lot of attention for being so amazingly talented and being so young. Do you feel like that is that was like a burden to have to deal with? Do you feel like that's something you can kind of shed happily now? Or
no, I mean, now that I'm old, it's fine. And also, I think I was just born old, and I feel like I'm getting younger all the time, which is kind of fun for me, but will be confusing for others, for others possibly. I've become more. Perhaps I've realized I'm not serious as I thought that I was.
Well, so serious in what way? Because this book, I mean, there's a lot of humor in it, but it's not an unserious book.
This book has a lot of heavy things in it, but the people in it still manage to move through their lives without those weights on them quite so much. And I think that is an outlook that's coming to me as I get older.
Helen Oyeyemi's new book is called Boy, Snow, Bird. Helen, it was a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
That was lovely. Thank you.
If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. So wake me up when it's all over, when I'm wiser and I'm older. This is the most streamed song ever on Spotify. Wake Me Up by Swedish DJ Avicii. A lot of people assume that was Avicii singing, which makes sense. The actual singer wasn't even listed. That singular voice belongs to Allo Black. He actually wrote the lyrics months before the collaboration with Avicii.
I was on a flight from Geneva to Los Angeles. It was just a moment where I felt like my life could get no better. I was really happy with how things were going and sitting in first class because the organization that invited me to Geneva paid for everything. And I thought, wow, you know, from indie label, struggling artist to first class flights, I thought, wake me up when it's all over.
Allo Black's new album, Lift Your Spirit, includes a stripped-down version of the song.
When I first recorded the song, we recorded an acoustic version. It was just Mike Einziger from Incubus on his guitar. A couple days later, Avicii made his dance remix, but I'd always had an affinity for the acoustic version and wanted my fans to hear the song for its songwriting and not the steroids of dance music around it.
I can't tell where the journey will end, but I know where to start.
You're the really big hit right now, The Man. That's the first single off this album. It's been climbing up the Billboard charts. And like Wake Me Up, that sort of turned into a popular anthem. What is it about these songs you think that are...
Well, my goal, of course, is to make songs that will last the test of time and to be worthy of the space in your mind. I want to create themes that hold your attention.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.
The Man was a theme that I wrote based on, of course, an Elton John interpolation. I took one line from an Elton John song and part of the melody as well and made a loop of it. I come from a hip-hop background, and that's what we do quite often.
Mm-hmm.
The lyrics I wrote were to try to impress Dr. Dre.
Did it work?
The song ended up in Beats by Dre commercial, so I think it worked.
Stand up now and face the sun. Won't hide my tail or turn and run. It's time to do what must be done. Be a king when kingdom comes.
You've had a pretty enthusiastic but select audience. And now it feels like you're hitting it big in a way that seems very much reflective of our new times. Like it wasn't radio stations got behind you, it wasn't record stores.
It seems to me like the third way is television shows and television commercials. It's been extremely helpful in my career. I Need a Dollar was the first.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey.
With the licensing for the theme of How to Make It in America, the HBO special. And since then, I've had a few songs from this album that have been synced to television commercials and sporting events. And that's been extremely helpful in magnifying my voice and getting the music out there for people to hear and decide whether they like it enough to go find it and buy it.
I'm talking with Aloe Black. His new album is called Lift Your Spirit. My favorite track might be Love is the Answer.
Broken hearts everywhere, from stepping on up, we don't care. Somebody tell me what we gonna do.
That was a collaboration with Pharrell.
Yes.
What was it like working with him?
First of all, it was an honor to work with Pharrell. Of course, I set my sights on working with really talented and accomplished producers. Pharrell would be one, but I never thought I would have the chance. And he happened to be in L.A. And I had finished my album, at least I thought I had. Pharrell was eager to challenge what I thought was a finished album with creating a new song. Finished a song within 5 hours, 4 to 5 hours. I loved it. I thought it was worth putting on the album for sure.
You hit a lot of different feelings, a lot of different moods on this album. What was missing there that this song helps complete?
Well, we were able to do something that was analogous to my heroes, Michael Jackson, Bob Marley, Stevie Wonder, where you create a wonderful pop song and put an awesome message in the middle of it. Just believe in love, the only thing that's real and true.
Hey, love is the answer. The title is Lift Your Spirit, and they're pretty happy songs, generally pretty uplifting, but there's one tune in particular, though, that takes a different turn.
Yeah, that's a ticking bomb.
Yeah.
And, you know, I struggled with putting it on the album called Lift Your Spirit.
The whole world sitting on a ticking bomb. The whole world sitting on a ticking bomb. So keep your calm and carry on. The whole world sitting on a ticking bomb.
I have a relationship with an organization called Falling Whistles, and this organization does as much as they can to create awareness around the conflict in the Congo, which is a conflict around natural resources. And I think it's important for us to recognize it, realize it, and for me, as an artist who knows about this, to use my megaphone to bring awareness.
We're staring down a loaded gun. No refuge found, no solid ground.
Is there a feeling you might want to do more songs like that?
I absolutely will do more songs like that. I have a lot of them. But, you know, I got a pretty strict directive from my pops, who said to make a happier album this time. So this one's for pops.
Seems like you can play about any style you want to. What haven't you accomplished that you want to do?
You know, what would be really nice for me is to really get into the country music production and songwriting field. I spend a lot of time crafting my words. I look at traditional country music as some of the strongest songwriting that we've been able to deliver from the United States.
People used to make fun of Charlie Parker for listening to country music, and he said, Those cats know how to tell a story.
That's my goal. I feel accomplished whenever a song becomes popular that I've done a good job telling a story.
Aloe Black, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Come on, lift your spirits, hand those to cheese.
Kids for Cash. That was the shorthand in countless newspaper articles back in 2009, describing a major corruption scandal in the juvenile justice system in Northeast Pennsylvania. Two local judges had been enforcing a zero-tolerance policy for bad behavior by kids. Even minor offenses like fighting in school or underage drinking could mean hard time in a juvenile detention facility. Federal prosecutors said the judges were actually getting kickbacks from private detention facilities in return for keeping the centers full of thousands of kids. They received cash. Both judges are now serving time in federal prison, but a new documentary called Kids for Cash is reexamining the case with interviews with both judges and the children who were locked up.
For all those years, I missed high school. I never went to a prom. on my birthdays until my recent one, my 19th birthday, I was always in a placement somewhere.
Robert May directed the film, and he's also a resident of Northeast Pennsylvania. He followed the constant coverage of the scandal in his area. And over the course of 4 years, he set out to learn more.
Stories are never one-dimensional. There's always multi-dimensions to a story, and I think that's what really attracted me, is how could something like this happen, and what's the behind-the-scenes side of the story?
And you managed to get on-camera interviews with both judges involved in this case, Mark Chivarella and Michael Conahan. What did you learn from talking to them?
Well, first, we weren't even going to make the movie unless we could really tell the story from the villain and the victim side. And, you know, when I first met with Mark Chivarella and approached him on the idea of doing this film, and of course, I didn't know these folks at all. First, I had to make sure he understood that he was the villain, and he said that he was. Secondly, is that he ultimately agreed to do the film, but he did not want to tell his attorneys that he was actually participating in the film. And that was the same with Judge Conahan. And I think that was sort of the first peering into how important perhaps they thought it was for them to tell their side of the story.
And I want to talk about Mark Chivarella as a judge, because before the scandal, he had this reputation as being this very popular judge for getting tough with juvenile crime. Now, when a kid's sent to juvenile detention, you think it's going to be for something pretty serious, like stealing a car or assaulting somebody. Could you talk about the kind of things these kids were sent away for?
Well, I can. And also, though, to your point, he was elected in 1996 for his zero tolerance position, and he was reelected again for a second 10-year term. And so the community applauded him. Schools applauded him. Police applauded him. He would go into schools, and he would warn kids, if you come before me, I will send you away. And so when a kid came before him, and if there was a, quote, school crime, now this could be a kid getting into a fight. In our case, we had a girl who did a fake MySpace page, and they came before him, and he would say, like, do you remember me being in your school? And most of the kids did remember. And he said, well, do you remember what I said? And some of the kids remembered, some of them didn't. And he would say, like, I said I would send you away. Get him out of here. And that's pretty much what would happen.
So you go into how it came out through a federal investigation that these judges received a big cash payment from the juvenile detention facility. As you're interviewing these judges, they're maintaining all the time that these payments, they were not kickbacks, they were a finder's fee, that they should have reported them and declared them on their taxes, but they were not taking kickbacks.
That's right. Judge Chivarella in particular said, look, you know, this was a finder's fee. We needed the center built. And I was always jailing kids.
I wanted these kids to think that I was the biggest SOB that ever lived. I wanted them to be scared out of their minds when they had to deal with me, because I was hoping, because of that, that they would never put themselves in a position again where they had to come back and deal with me.
He said, look, I was always locking kids up because that's what they needed. What's the big deal now? I mean, everybody was celebrating me, you know, all these years, and now they're not happy with me anymore just because I took this money. I don't think he quite grasps the connection that people are making.
So has it, beyond this one scandal, has this changed the way you look at the entire country's handling of juvenile justice?
It has, because we have screened the film all around the country in pre-release screenings to both moviegoers and also folks that are very familiar with the juvenile system. I had a judge in Washington, D.C. take me aside after he saw the film and say to me, look, I've done all these things except I haven't taken any money. And I think what it shows is that these kinds of treatments of children are unknown to the public. They're unknown to parents. Schools, who are the biggest contributor, actually, into the juvenile system, they don't exactly know what happens to kids once they leave the school. All they know is maybe a troublemaking kid is now gone and they don't see them again. And I think what we see from people who sort of know the system and people who don't, we get the same reaction. They're emotional and they're outraged. And in so many places around the country, we have people saying, that's happening here. Hmm. You know, it's just that maybe there aren't millions of dollars involved. Maybe that's the difference.
That's Robert May. He's the director of the new film, Kids for Cash. He joined us from member station WVIA in Pittston, Pennsylvania. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here at All Things Considered, we're collecting stories of triumph, big and small, moments when people make great leaps forward in their careers. We call it My Big Break. Actor Ed Harris has taken on some memorable roles, everything from astronaut John Glenn to painter Jackson Pollock. But he feels his most memorable performance came back in 1973.
I had studied acting for just a year at Oklahoma University. I'd been pretty much a jock up to that point, played football and baseball, and realized that wasn't going anywhere. The teacher that I had, who was a wonderful teacher, he was directing a production of Camelot in Oklahoma City the following year and asked me to audition. I was working as a night watchman in an apartment complex during that time, and I did the audition. I really had not done very much theater. I mean, I'd done a few plays at college. And then I got a call from him that he wanted me to play King Arthur. And I was very excited. It was a jewel box theater, 220 seats. I had put a yardstick up on my back and they tied it to me so my posture would be good during rehearsals. I remember the songs, you know. How to handle a woman. There's a way, said a wise old man. A way known by every woman since the whole rigmarole began. And it, you know, goes on. Anyway. One night we did the show, and I don't remember doing the play at all. Really, I mean, seriously, I did not remember doing the play. I was just in another zone. I was in it. I only remember coming off the stage and hearing this roar go up and went back after the curtain call, and 220 Oklahomans were on their feet cheering, and I had this feeling of complete ecstasy. Probably the most high I've been ever in any way. What it did was not only convince me that this was something to pursue, but ever since, you know, you try to get back there. I mean, it's almost like you spend the rest of your life trying to get back to that state where you're just present, doing it, no thought other than doing this character in this play or this film. I don't know if it'll ever happen again that way. The Camelot experience obviously is not a traditional kind of big breakthrough in terms of a career, but it was a big break for me personally as a human being who has decided he wants to act. It was an internal realization that you have no choice now, buddy. This is what you're going to do.
Oscar-nominated actor Ed Harris. His new film, The Face of Love, is in select theaters now. We want to hear about your big break. Send an email with your story to My Big Break, all one word, at npr.org. Again, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky.
Diane Reeves has received just about all the accolades a jazz singer could. She's been described as part of the great tradition that stretches through singers like Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan. But strict traditionalists might be taken aback by the music on her new album, Beautiful Life, which has Reeves sounding a lot more like a soul singer. One reason for that sound might be that this album has a lot of new collaborators.
One of the main inspirations for this record was that I was listening to all these young jazz musicians. They were being greatly inspired by the music that I came up listening to. So I thought, wow, this is a good place to have a conversation. And so that's why people like Esperanza Spalding and Robert Glasper, even Gregory Porter, Layla Hathaway, all of these musicians were a part of this record. And I thought it would be very interesting to see, you know, where the music could go. And this whole project ended up being this great collaborative experience and experiment.
Listen to the wild rose in bloom.
Well, let's talk about one of those tunes. Wild Rose is one that's got, again, an amazing lineup. You got Esperanza Spalding, who wrote the tune, and Ingrid Jensen, trumpet player, Sheila E. Yeah. What's it like when you assemble that group?
I love this song because she gave it to me Christmas of 2012, and I thought, wow, this is the best Christmas gift I've ever received. So, you know, just coming in, it's like any other session. You have these great professional musicians, and you come in and you put it down.
I'm sure you know you've been very celebrated as a jazz singer, as being part of this great tradition. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, have you had any pushback from people who, you know, maybe this is moving away from what they might traditionally consider jazz, and they want you to stay in that box?
Well, I think people have come to know that I am not comfortable in a box, you know, and that I love music. I don't really look at music in terms of genres and all of that, because the music experience that I grew up in, I mean, you had people like Marvin Gaye, which, you know, we did a Marvin Gaye song, but, you know, you would see jazz musicians on his record. Jazz musicians talked about Marvin, and Marvin talked about them as well. You attended concerts that, you know, you could see Ravi Shankar and Miles Davis on the same bill. So music was without boundaries. I love that part, that it's not broken down into pieces. So when people listen to this record, it's music, and it has a different flavor and a different taste, and it's served in a different way, but it's still Diane Reeves. I want you the right way, baby. I want you, but I want you to want me too.
A lot of the songs on this album are covers of tunes. You have Marvin Gaye, Fleetwood Mac, Bob Marley. I want to talk to you about 32 Flavors, though. That's an Ani DiFranco song originally. What attracted you to that tune?
Oh, the lyric, because, you know, Ani DiFranco is such an incredible wordsmith. Squint your eyes and look a bit closer. I'm not between you and you know, it was funny because that song was with me for a while, and I did it in every kind of way. I always improvised a melody around it. If I did it, you know, on stage, I would just, my band never knew how I was going to call it. We would create something on stage and do it. And it was the power of the lyric, you know, that allowed me to do that and to make it something different every night. And then I said, I want to record this. This is what happened. And I love it. One day you're gonna get hungry and eat all the words you just said. Ooh,
yeah. I want to talk about one of your tunes that's on this album, Tango. First off, wow. How do you write a tune like that? Does that just come straight out of you?
Yes, it does. You know, all my life, I love music, and I have music from all over the world. You know, my records are one thing. My live performances are something totally different because they're very improvised performances. And I will have a section of the show where, you know, I just do what I want to do, what I'm feeling in the moment. And this melody just kept coming to me, and I just kept building on it and building on it, and ended up being this song, Tango. Hi-ya-ee-dee-dee-dee, It's really a dedication to all of those records that I own of artists who don't sing in English, sing in other foreign languages, but still communicate the power of what they're saying through their emotions and their spirit, all of those kinds of things. And so that's kind of what this song was born out of.
Diane Reeves, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
It's my pleasure.
Diane Reeves' new album is called Beautiful Life, and it's out right now. For the week ending March 9th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, Lina Anwar, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is our technical director, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo Dell'Aquila. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Phil Harrell is standing in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.